Something. They called you Junior when you played. Why?
My right name.
Is it?
Yes, sir.
I'll be done.
Eugene, and I go by Gene.
Okay.
I don't know why, but that's what they hung on me when I was when I arrived on this earth.
I've got a client whose given name is Junior.
Is that not very often?
No, don't see it often. It's his middle name, actually, but that's what he goes by.
Well, this was my first one, first name.
I'll be darned. It's... I don't know, I've heard people complain about it being stuck on the end. Maybe that's the reason. You started off like a house of fire your first 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
13 wins, then 16 wins. Mm-hmm. And then you tapered off. What happened?
Well, I've told this story a million times, and I wish I could tell you what happened other than what I'm going to relate to you. It's the weirdest thing in the world. I had pitched a game. It was late in the season. It wasn't too long ahead of the World Series in 40. I pitched a game against the Cardinals in St. Louis, my first game of doubleheader. Pitched a two-hit shutout. Recall the game as if it were yesterday. Enos Fowler got both hits off of me and shut him out 2-0. And after the game was over, my wife, we lived quite close to St. Louis, about 125 miles. Since this game was on a Sunday, and my wife is... She had driven down from Decatur. She had been home. We'd been on a road trip, and she was at home, which is, as I say, about 125 miles away. And Mr. McKechnie, our manager, knew that she was there. And after the first game, I pitched and won. Ordinarily, in those days, just because you pitched 9 innings and won, that don't mean you're done for the day, you know,
right,
like it is now. And he looked at me and he said, "Hey, I see Dorothy's here, my wife." I called my wife, first name. We were all like a big family of that group then. He said, "I see Dorothy's here." And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Hey, I just thought, you know, you had a good day today. Why don't you go ahead home tonight with her, and then she'll be driving back to Cincinnati. We had an off day on Monday, and then won't play till Tuesday night." I said, "Hey, that's fine. That's great. I really appreciate it." So after the game was over, she and I drove on home. And I get up the next morning, and I can't raise my arm. And I don't know to this day, and nobody else does, what happened. I couldn't wait till Tuesday night to get to Cincinnati and get my suit on and try to throw because I was hurting so badly in my shoulder. I went to doctors, and everybody said, "Well, it's your teeth, and it's this, and it's that, and everything else," and they started giving me x-ray, and nobody knew what the heck it was. Well, that's the only way I know to answer your question, and from then on, I had problems.
Well, you came back a few years later to have at least one darn good year in relief.
Well, I came back, but it was, hell, I was under halfway under sedation of aspirins daily by the half hands full and x-ray treatment and everything else. And changed my style of pitching a lot. I wasn't able to throw near as hard and did a lot more finessing when I, you know, after the last two, three years I tried to pitch. And then
mm-hmm.
If you notice that from that time on, I was mainly used out of the bullpen.
Right, yeah.
With Cincinnati and also New York. I couldn't pitch. I could pitch 2 or 3 innings, and then if I didn't pitch any more than that, I could rebound pretty good within the next day or so. But if I pitched any lengthy time at all, then I was laid up for a week or 10 days, which I found out and which I explained to them, and that's the way they started using me. I just didn't respond near like I used to. You know, I had been before.
Did you ever?
To this day, I can't tell anybody, you or anybody else, what happened to my arm.
Have you ever talked to any of the trainers and doctors in the game today and see if they have any idea?
Yeah, what did you say?
Have you ever talked to any of the trainers or the doctors, the sports medical people today to see if they might have had an idea of what happened to you?
Oh, I never did, Brent. It just didn't seem, I never entered my mind to do it because it just didn't seem like it was, you know.
Yeah, a little late for a comeback, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I tried to pitch that, to start the game in the third game of the World Series against Detroit. That year, and it just didn't have anything. You know, it just didn't have enough to get by with.
What was your best pitch when you were all right?
You know, I don't know. I couldn't even tell you. I couldn't even tell you. I had been rated both one time, sometimes a fastball pitcher, sometimes a curveball pitcher. I threw a lot of breaking stuff. I crossfired some and maybe was a little bit different, you know, a little unorthodox at times, more than other people in my style, as I recall myself. Looking back now.
Was the game that you evidently were hurt in, sounds like a pretty good game. Is that your best game?
Sound like what?
Sounded like it was a pretty good game. Is that your best performance?
Well, Oh, I don't know. My best one, I had pitched, you know, several games that I would consider probably as good as. I was real close to a no-hitter one day in Brooklyn. We wound up with a one-hitter. Riggs hit a, Lou Riggs had gone to Brooklyn at the time. He hit a kind of a flare-type base hit off me for one base hit. I suppose it would be one of the better games, Brent, yes.
Who were you best against consistently, if there was anybody?
Who was I best?
Yeah, who did you perform best against?
Well, I think everybody has these kind of clubs, and I probably could say that my best luck was against the Giants.
Mm-hmm.
Seemingly it was.
Who was toughest for you? What team?
Oh, I don't know that I could single out anybody that was tougher than anybody else on me. It seemed like I had problems with everybody, like everybody went out on the mound, but I suppose maybe even a club like Pittsburgh at the time, if I'd have to name a club.
Mm-hmm.
Just off, you know, without giving it a whole lot of thought. And looking back, I don't know what the record might have shown. Have no idea. I never did pay that much attention to them.
Over the years, occasionally there's appeared articles in various magazines about the Reds teams of 39-40 that the only member up until Lombardi that was in the Hall of Fame was the manager. What about Derringer and Walters? Do they belong in the Hall of Fame, in your opinion?
Brent, Kelly, I have to tell you the same thing I've told people, that it was such a privilege and an honor to be on the same staff with two people like Derringer and Walters.
Mm-hmm.
I looked up to those people like you do the Lord, almost, in their greatness and the accomplishments that they had. If you recall that one year, those two guys won 52 games for us.
Right.
Together to win one of the pennants. And outstanding. Just absolutely outstanding. Of course, you know Paul's gone.
Right.
I had a letter from Bucky yesterday. He's in bad shape. He's down to about 135 pounds, which makes me just sick.
Oh, boy.
You know, to think about him being, he's had a kidney failure, and he's on a dialysis.
That's a shame.
80 years old. Outstanding people. Outstanding performers. And great, you know, just great competitors. I looked up their records, and you look up these boys now. The guy pitches a complete game, he gets headlines.
Yeah.
And I looked back on those guys, and they were pitching 20 and 25 complete games a year. I'm not talking about wins, I'm just talking about complete games.
I understand. You have to think if they pitched in New York, they'd both be in the Hall of Fame at this point.
Oh, no doubt about it. I think, yes, because our club, you know, we're kind of short on publicity over there until we got on the map by winning two pennants in a row.
I guess that was still, at that time, the smallest market of all the major league areas, wasn't it? Cincinnati?
It was at the time, yes.
Yeah.
And it was, most people considered it quite difficult to play in, except I think for us, our pitching staff was more or less, molded for it because we had a lot of sinker ball type pitchers and you kept the ball out of the air.
Mm-hmm.
And this, of course, is the name of the game.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, those kind of parks.
Well, it still is today, except some of those great big things are in.
Yeah, but not in here. I don't understand.
I said that you still got to keep it down today, except for some of those great big, humongous parks they have nowadays.
Especially in those kind of parks like we have then, you know.
Yeah, right.
We hit the ball, make people hit the ball on the ground. We had some of the greatest infielders I ever saw. I mean, these people turning double plays like they were going out of style. Get you out of innings and, you know, just in great shape.
Well, that's a help, isn't it?
Oh, mercy, yes. This is what... Everybody talked about how great our pitching was, and we all appreciated that on a pitching staff, but we all had to turn right around and say, hey, you know, these guys with the leather on, it makes a little difference. And with a combination that we had, like Brian Myers at second, you know, second and short, and with not to mention the guy at third that played up pretty good, Werber, and then, in my opinion, a guy that's been most unheralded as a first baseman was Frank McCormick. And nobody ever seems to mention his name, but in our opinion, the people who played with him or played against him, he was outstanding. He's dead too, of course.
Speaking of playing against, who was the best player you think you played against?
The best player?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would have to think the best player I played in probably wasn't in our league, and I say this because we played against him a number of times. not only in the World Series in 39, but in spring training, I'd say DiMaggio was the best player that I ever played against.
Who was the toughest hitter you personally faced?
Mark Yvonne. No problem in my mind to give you that. Mark Yvonne.
He knew what was coming.
And he wasn't bad. It took him a long time to get in the Hall of Fame, too.
Sure did.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did.
On the Reds, again, of 39 and 40, the tragedy of Willard Hershberger committing suicide, was that any way that that could have been foreseen?
It was foreseen, Brent. I kind of hate to talk about something like this because there's a lot of things here that's, that needs to go unsaid.
Okay, well, that's all right. Forget it then. No big deal.
Well,
now, if you want to, great. If you don't, that's fine.
Willard, between you and I, Willard Hershberger, Brent, was a real hypochondriac to start with. We all were aware of this.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that triggered this that we all put together later and by sitting down talking to McKechnie, and he filled us in on a lot of things we didn't know until after the death. Our club, we had just left Brooklyn. I had gotten cut in a fight over there. I was on crutches. Lombardi had gotten hurt, mainly the reason I should tell this story more than my own being hurt, but Lombardi had gotten hurt. He hung a spike up in a back by the net in the Brooklyn ballpark, and he wasn't able to catch. As a result of this, the whole job fell on the shoulders of little Willard Hershberger, who was quite an athlete, I'll tell you. He was a good catcher and he was a good hitter, but I think the responsibility of him having to take over at that such a time when the going was real tough because we were in a, as you know, in a pennant drive at that time. When we moved out of Brooklyn and we went to New York, in the meantime, my wife and I came home, so I wasn't in Boston when he committed suicide. They sent me back on crutches. He was catching, needless to say, was catching all the games, and Bucky Walters was pitching, and they had beaten Bucky on a home run. I forget Ott or who was it hit the home run over him. Anyway, I think Hershey felt like it was his fault, and he would carry these things and they would bother him, it'd worry him. And I think maybe McKechnie might have said something to him that no different than he would say to somebody else, you know, like, what in the world was that pitch or whatever, you know, and I think it just preyed on him. Then they went on to Boston, the ball club did, and as I say, I didn't go, but we had four doubleheaders in a row in Boston.
Oh, Lord.
And Hershberger, of course, was going to have to catch because the only other catcher we had was just a mediocre kind of a guy by the name of Bill, his last name right now. Anyway, it was his razor that he cut his throat with.
Oh.
Bill became an umpire. I'll think of his name in a minute. Anyway, they go on to Boston, and when they go to the ballpark the first day.
Bill Baker?
Say what?
Bill Baker?
Bill Baker.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, he and Hershberger were rooming together. And when they got to the ballpark, Hershey didn't show up. And Bill started asking, Bill McKechnie started asking, you know, what's the story? And he asked Baker, he said, what's the story? Is your room with him? He said, well, he told me to go ahead this morning. He'd be on out later. Needless to say, he didn't show up. And there was a shoe man, a guy was a shoe salesman, was quite a good friend of the ballplayers there, a guy named McCohen, which we all knew. We used to buy stuff from him. McKechnie asked him, he knew he was a real good friend of Hershberger's, and he asked him if he'd go look about it. And this Cohen went back to the hotel, and that's when they got the manager or detective or something, went to the room and found him dead. Found him. He had cut his throat with a single-edged blade, razor blade, that belonged to Baker. After this was all over with, then Bill had a meeting with us, or a little later after they got back on the road trip. And he said that Willard had come to him and told him he was going to commit suicide the night before. And he said he had sat up with him nearly half the night. And he said he felt very confident, Bill did, that he had gotten him talked out of it. And this was when it came out more especially that Hershberger was concerned about having to carry the load and Lombardi wasn't going to be able to catch him, or he was just one of those kind of people that it just bothered him. He was satisfied to be second in line, you know,
yeah,
and pick up here and there, but he couldn't stand the pressure of being the number one catcher when we were in such a fight. And I think this about covers it. I say he was a hypochondriac, and his father had committed suicide also years before.
Mm.
He was a single boy.
Do you, when I write this up, do you want me to leave this out, or you know, it's up to you?
I didn't understand.
When I write this up, do you want me to leave this part out?
I'd tone it down a lot if I were you, because I just think that there are some things that need to be unsaid.
Well, I don't think we'll gain anything by it. That's all right.
There was some speculation about things that happened, but I don't know. I don't think it would help anything for anybody to bring it up now.
No, not really. You're right.
He was quite an outstanding person, and he was a good ball player. A good ball player.
Always hit well.
We had played against him. I had played against him before in the old International League back in a number of years before that, back in '37, and in there when he was at Newark, along with the Yankees.
Talking about International League, what kind of minor league record did you have?
I couldn't even tell you. My first year, I signed in 34. Incidentally, this is my 55th year this year in October. I signed in 1934, and I went out in 35, and I played for Milton Stock. I had a very short year that year. I was real young. I was only 17 years old, and I didn't stay but about half a season. I was sent home. The next year, I went out to down the old Kitty League. I won 20 games in there. The next year, I had a pretty decent year in Peoria in the Three-Eyed League, and then I won 13, 14 games there, but just about July, something like that, July 4th, and I went to the Western League for a couple of days, and then they sent me on to the International League, where I didn't get a pitch a whole lot. That was at 37, and then 38, I went back to the International League. I didn't pitch but very little. Went to the Sally League, where I had, I think I was 13-5 in the Sally League, and I didn't get there till July the 10th, something like that, you can see how much they pitched me down.
Right.
Then I went to big leagues in 39. And then I went to Coast League after I left the Giants in 48.
How long were you in the Coast League?
How long what?
How long did you play in the Coast League?
I played out there for Rip Collins in 48 and Bucky Harris in 49 and went to Sacramento, sold to Sacramento in 50. In the middle of the 50 season, I gave it up and went to coaching. I coached the rest of the 50 season for Joe Marty and then coached the 51 season for Joe Gordon. Then went to South America and managed the club, and then this is my 38th year scouting.
Been with the Giants the whole time?
Scouting?
Yes.
All but 4 years I worked for Chicago.
Cubs?
Yes. 78 through, 78, 79, 80, 81.
Who are the best players that you've signed over the years?
This is always a kind of a tricky question, and I'm going to have to make this remark to you first and so you'll understand where I'm coming from. And for many, many years when I was with the Giants, when I first started with them, there was three of us people, scouts, all of us, that did nothing but take in and run tryout camps in our spring training headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't allow, the other scouts around the country weren't allowed to sign players. They sent them to us to look at them first. Then we would pick them out. During that period of time, over those years, there was quite a number of pretty good players signed. Of course, none of me nor the other two scouts, both of them are dead now, ever got any credit for the people that we signed out there. We would have sure caught hell if we hadn't signed them, and they'd have turned up with somebody else. But as a result of our not signing them, the scouts that sent them in would be the one that got the credit. I'm saying this for a purpose. In one particular camp down there, we signed six players at one time, all Caribbeans. And they were Zepeda and Pagan and Julio Navarro. Those were three that we didn't get any credit for. Next year, we signed McCovey out of this group.
Wow.
It was on and on and on. Now, since that time, I never have paid a lot of attention to how many I've signed. I've signed a whole bunch of players. As a matter of fact, when I was with Chicago, I signed the Leopard kid that's with us now. I signed a Hatcher boy that was just traded with Chicago. They originally were.
Mm-hmm.
I signed a kid named a right-hand pitcher that we traded to Cleveland in the Sutcliffe deal, and I had about half a dozen kids working for me there. Now, then, on through here, I'd signed old guys like Haller and quite a few people I've signed with San Francisco also.
Anybody on the Giants roster today, other than Lefferts, that you signed?
Lefferts, I signed, and then I signed McCammett, kid that just went up for just the other day.
Right.
The going to be their next shortstop, I feel sure, giving him a Benjamin. Has been up and down this year. I can't think of anybody else right now.
Okay, an aside, Giants look pretty tough right now, don't they?
The what?
The Giants look pretty doggone good right now, don't they?
Well, they do one day and then the next day they don't, Brent. It's kind of, they're kind of hard to, decipher.
I hope they can do it. My son and I, they're playing here in Cincinnati on Labor Day. We're going up Labor Day evening and watch them play. We didn't get to see them last time.
Great.
Okay, a couple more. But you say 55 years in baseball, there have been some changes made. What are the main ones that you've seen?
A whole bunch of them. We talk about this all the time. I think the things that I could remark about being changed is that one that's been told so many times in recent years. I was sitting around one time a number of years ago with a bunch of old-timers. The question always comes up, what in the world happened to our game and this, that, and everything else, you know. One of the old guys get up and he said, I can tell you what's happened to our game, and I think this probably tells a lot of stories. It's the lack of respect that these people have today for managers or management. And I think there's a lot in this, you know, when you really think about it, and you see the things that go on today, I think the other thing that I've noticed more than anything is the way pitching is handled over the years. I mean, since I played, and like I've just mentioned to you, that just because you pitched 9 innings, that didn't mean you're going to get have the rest of the day off. You know, if you got 9 innings now, hell, he can go fishing for 5 days. He ain't going to be bothering. He's going to pitch batting practice. I think they've made such a specialty game out of it, and I can't say it's for the better. Because if you stop and realize today that these owners are paying not only paying one pitcher for each win, but they're paying in most parts at least three and maybe four pitchers for the same win. I elaborated on this by saying you got a starter that hell he never goes over five or six innings anymore, and he's looked for help. Then you got a long man and he gets a whole bunch of money because he's the guy in between. Then you go to your stopper. You know, your closer.
What
I'm saying in part here is you got three guys getting paid for the same damn victory. That just like I mentioned to you earlier today, the guys like Wallers and those guys, hell, they'd pitch 25, 30 complete games a year.
You've got guys today pitching 60, 70 innings a year making $1 million.
That's what I'm talking about.
That's
absolutely ridiculous.
I can't understand that. That's just more power to them. I'm glad they're getting the money. But,
Look, I'm not against it. I'm just saying you were asking me about changes.
Right.
That's what I'm, you know.
Yes, I agree. Okay, well, that's good. It's a difficult concept to grasp. Are there any changes you think should be made today?
Oh, I wouldn't even want to get into that, because I'm just getting about ready to get out of it.
This is the best time to make the changes when you're not going to be around.
Let me tell you real quick the changes that could be made.
Okay.
We see, you've been chasing this thing around for a long time, haven't you, Brent? I mean, the big league baseball.
Oh, well, I am 48 years old, so I've been playing since I was about eight.
You'll know where I'm coming from when I say I have never heard tell of so damn many bad arms in my life.
Oh, amen.
Disabled list, my God, I never heard so much of disabled in my life. Now, I'm talking about pitchers.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like to live in the past. That's the reason why a lot of times I hate to start answering questions, because the people around me a lot of times say, oh, hell, you old bastard, you live in the past, you know, and all that this, that, and everything. You know, so I most of the time just kind of refuse to even talk about it and give my opinion. But what I'm talking about is I think that every one of these ball clubs should have to go back or should go back to a four-man pitching rotation. I don't, hell, you can't find four starters anymore. I don't know how in the hell they think they can find five.
Yeah.
Okay, our routine then, I might add this first. Do you realize that there's not a pitcher in the big leagues today that ever throws batting practice?
No, I didn't realize that.
They don't. You know what they do when a team comes down your part of the country or Cincinnati or our team goes down there, Atlanta? They got a guy that lives around there. They hired to pay to pitch bat practice.
Wow.
I'm not kidding. Now, what I'm saying here is that the batting practice, even though we were on a four-man rotation, we threw batting practice in between our starts. And we're talking about every third day now, you know, fourth day.
Mm-hmm.
We threw batting practice, and we ran like hell all the time. So we had to be in pretty good condition. And again, on the same side of the ledger, we pitched a hell of a lot more complete games than these people now. We got people then that pitch more games complete by one person than some of these guys are pitching on a whole staff or even a league, I think.
Oh, a big staff nowadays. Heck, it's 10 complete games a year.
Okay. When I was with Chicago, I went back there one day just to show you the point. I went back there for our draft meeting, and I picked up the paper, a newspaper that morning. I got off the airplane. And a big headline. This is June now, and somebody on our staff at Chicago had pitched a complete game, and it was about an inch and a half high in June before the first one was pitched.
Wow.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And you know they don't want to throw bat practice. They don't want anybody even bother with them. But here you're pitching less innings and taking one more day's rest. Now does that make sense?
Talk about now, you see it all the time, this is a man who's going to pitch 200 innings for somebody. And the 200 innings, that was the fourth, fifth, or sixth man on teams back when you were playing.
You fed on. I can get my Bible down, my encyclopedia, and look through there and show you guys, you know, 300 innings plus wasn't anything.
Right.
For those people in those days. I mean, the starters.
Right, yeah, of course.
And, you know, I'm looking back now as I'm talking to you, and I'm trying to think, we're talking about Bucky and Paul. Hell, I don't remember those guys ever being on disabled list. I'm sure they might have been at some time or other.
Well, nowadays, all it takes is a hangnail for somebody to be laid up for 15 days.
Not a month.
No heart.
You know, I got to tell you this little story, and I've enjoyed telling it so many times because it's just kind of related to what we're talking about here. I pitched a game against the Giants in Cincinnati. I forget if it was 39 or 40, one or the other. Hot, not damn it hot. And as you know, it can get hot there.
And it sure can.
Especially. And I beat the Giants in the first game, the doubleheader. And we go to the clubhouse. Now, as I said a minute ago, just because I'd pitched nine innings, you know, I didn't just go ahead and get dressed and start going toward the door. You sat there and you didn't ask. You didn't even ask the manager. You waited until he told you either get dressed or, you know, go on home or shower or whatever. So I'm sitting in the front of my locker and starting to get my clothes off. That's 30 minutes or so between games. And I look up and McKechnie's standing in front of me. And he's looking at me over the top of his glasses like he always did at us. And he stood there, it seemed like he stood there for an hour, probably 15 seconds. And he finally said, well, I'll tell you what. He said, go ahead and get dressed. And he said, I want to see you sitting down there with your wife, and I don't want you to drink a beer. I may need you. Okay. So I went down, got dressed, and went down. I sat in the middle of the missus, and about the sixth inning, I heard a whistle, a real shrill whistle, which if anybody whistled like this now, I'd jump right straight up because I knew it was Bill. I heard this shrill whistle, I'm looking down toward the bench, and he's giving me the motion to come down and get my uniform on. I'd pitch nine now. I went down and got my uniform on. He met me at the runway coming out of the old, into the dugout there in the old Crosley Field. And he said, hey, can you give me an inning or two? And I said, well, yeah, sure. He said, well, go ahead down. I'll let you know. I know more than get down there. And I think Grissom was pitching and he was in trouble. So he, you know, give me a sign, go ahead and start throwing. I went in the seventh and finished it. And, you know, if you do this now, somebody would have, they'd call their lawyer.
Oh yeah.
Call their agent.
I'm sure the contracts won't allow it.
That's right. I'm not trying to blow my own horn here. I don't mean this, but I'm just painting this because not only I did this, but I saw other people do the same damn thing. It wasn't just me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just talking separating the years.
Oh, I understand. Yeah. Yeah.
And you talk about hangnails. We had guys that, you know, I think the big difference too is, and you mentioned the hangnail, now a guy's afraid to get hurt because he was afraid somebody else was going to take his job.
Well, they've got long-term contracts now.
You got a guaranteed contract. What the hell, why should you have to worry?
Yeah. It's a sad commentary.
Then you didn't have anything guaranteed. I'm going to tell you something else before I forget it. I went to the big leagues, I was making $350 a month. I've told people this, and they say they don't believe it. And I said, well, you can come by my house, I'll show you my contracts, I still got them. I was raised, now this is 39, and about on June, I think my contract says that June 1st or June 15th, they raised me to $500 a month. Everybody said, well, there's a lot of difference in money. I said, hey, I understand that now. We're talking about $350 a month as compared to what the other you're talking about. This is not really inflation. This is something else.
So was it 80 or 68,000 or 70,000 a year minimum now?
That's my minimum. That's right.
Four.
I think it is 67.
And of course, the cost of living is different in the last 50 years, but not that much different.
That's right. Hell, these guys get more damn meal money than we were making, you know.
Yeah.
And Murphy money, they call it, walking around money. They get money for cleaning, they get money for tips, they get cab money, they get meal money, they get hotel money, they get everything.
What was your top salary?
I think my top salary was about $12,500. And when you made, if you got to the point, when I was pitching, if you got to the point where you...